Hello, dearest friends, and welcome back to another Fierce Feminine podcast. And back by popular demand, we have Richard Stanley with us once again. Richard is friend, muse, confidant, artiste, bohemian, scholar, film director. And has recently made another movie, Color Out of Space, which is going to be available. If you look down in the little text box down below, you will find out everything about Richard. But today we wanted to draw in a little bit closer on this Cathar legacy, this Cathar history, and we want to show you the triple goddess at play. Now, if you are a Cathar enthusiast, you may not have come across this aspect of the story, because if you take a wide view at the historical data that is on the Cathars, and it's not a lot, you will most likely miss this piece. But if you zoom in and get a little closer to the beating heart of what was once actually happening down here, you will get to meet three feminine aspects, all called Esclmonde, from little girl to young woman to crone mystic. There is no way I can come close to telling the tale of this story. There's only one person that can speak this with such clarity and depth. So let us go over once again to Richard here in the zone, situated at the moment in Renlaban. Over to you, Richard. Tell us about the triple goddess.
Well, thank you, Anaya. It's a pleasure to be joining you once again to talk of possibly one of the fiercest figures of feminine resistance in Western history. And this is the figure of Esclarmonde de Montségur, or possibly Na Esclarmonde, might have been the way we would have referred to it at the time, Na being a term of respect. And within this whole story is, at its core, is what's possibly the golden myth of Catharism, and this is the pure myth itself, which you encounter right at the outset if you're coming into the story, and that's the notion that before the fall of Montségur, the castle guarded within its walls the treasures of the Cathar faith, the sacred books, the monetary treasure, but also allegedly the Holy Grail itself. And with this grail comes the notion of the guardian of the grail, the high priestess of the Cathars, Esclarmonde de Montségur, whose name is variously interpreted as meaning the light of the world. And some think it also relates to éclair, the French word for lightning strike or lightning flash. She is a high priestess and a noble countess from an ancient Ibero-Celtic aristocracy, a bloodline that came from the south, very distinct from the northern lords and aristocrats at the time. I think most of them came out of immediately before her came out of the Comminges and this de Foix dynasty that led to the rise of the great Esclarmonde, possibly the best known of all of the Cathar high priestesses. And this great Esclarmonde was I have to check my timeline, was born all the way back in 1155. Esclarmonde de Foix. We call them the de Foix. The family seat is in the castle of Foix in the regional capital of the Ariège. In Catalan and in Occitan, that's pronounced Foix, and literally means faith. So again, we have a lady who's a real historical figure, but seems to have been called the light of the world of the faith, which is an extraordinary name for her to have since birth, given that she seems to have been marked out to be a Cathar saint or an apostle from literally from childhood, from her name alone. There's a myth that she encountered as a child, maybe as a 10-year-old. Papa Nicetas, the Bogomil Mystic, the Archbishop of Constantinople, who came to the south at the end of the 12th century to set up the formal Cathar Church that existed in those days. And the story is that as a 10-year-old already, she was marked out for her future destiny as the head of the Cathar Church, possibly by a secret sign or something that was passed between Nicetas and this young girl. But before she became the high priestess, she lived a full life already as a wife and mother. She was married at the age of 20 to the Viscount de Gimoes, Jourdain of the Isle, and bore him a bunch of children. We don't know all of their names, but we know some of their names, that between them they had Othon, Goulamet, Olive, and Bertrand were some of the kids. They were married for 20 years before her husband died, and she was, by all accounts, a good wife and mother. And it was only after the death of the husband that she took the cloth and took her vows to become a Cathar Perfecti. This took place in a ceremony in Fanjo in 1204, where we know that Esclamonde was initiated and raised to this position of high priestess. It was in a ceremony on, I know that on the same day there were three other women who also took the cloth. It was on the same day we see that Aude de Fanjo and Raymunda de Saint-Germain, a lady named Faye Durfort, were all raised as high priestesses on the same day in 1204. I don't know what happened to the other ladies, but judging by the names Aude and Faye and Madame Saint-Germain, they all sound like they must have been spectacular. Mm-hmm. But Esclamonde was a true saint and a Cathar Perfecti, which meant that she was a pacifist and someone who devoted her entire life largely to women's rights and to creating schools, convents, and shelters for single women. In that back in those days, there was a tendency, if you couldn't afford to pay the dowry, just to park your daughters in convents or to basically immure them. And much like in present-day Afghanistan, I think Esclamonde was very keen on educating your daughters and educating women. And I know she created a Cathar convent at Dun, near not far from Mirepoix. And of course, in about 1205, one of her first acts on becoming high priestess was to endow Montsegur as the Countess of Foix. She was able to channel funds and money coming from the tithes, the tax raised by Foix, into rebuilding Montsegur. And she reached out to the Lord of Montsegur, Raymond de Paray, who at that time, I believe, was only 17 years old. And came from the neighboring village of Paray, and in around 1205, she said that she would fund the refortification of the old ruins on top of the mountain. There was already a ruin there at the beginning of the 13th century. We don't really know what it was a ruin of, whether it was an old temple, an ancient observatory, a Roman ruin. It's hard to say what was on top of the pug. But from the beginning of the 13th century, thanks to Esclamonde's funding and her patronage, Montsegur was refortified and prepared for the siege. And they began to dig cisterns and to stockpile food and grain. And at the time of the Crusade, Montsegur then became the last bastion of the Cathar faith, the last sanctuary, which was something that had been prepared over a period of 39 years from the point that Raymond de Paray started rebuilding it. He was already in his middle age by the time the siege finally happened. We don't know if Esclamonde de Foix survived to see the siege. There's no record of her death. Like many of the Cathar Perfecti and the heads of the church, They had a habit of hiding the bodies of their leadership when they died, because the Holy Roman Church was so vindictive that if they couldn't get their hands on you while you were alive, they would often try to grab your corpse and scatter your heretic dust to the four winds, or quarter the corpses or mutilate them. So it's possible that Esclamon's body would have been hidden very deep beneath the pog. We know she was at Montsegur. She managed throughout her life and throughout the Crusade to stay ahead of the Inquisition. Before the onset of the Crusade, she actually famously addresses the papal legates at the Council of Pamir, which is when the papal legates order her to go back to her distaff, to go back to her spring, and refuse to take on board what she has to say. Then after the Crusader army sweeps down on the south, they try at every turn to capture her and kill her, but she always stays one step ahead of them, which is how she earns the nickname the Fox of Foix. There's some folk who say that this may also have been because she was a redhead. We don't know. We know that her brother Roger Ramon had red hair, who's described as the redheaded count, but image of Esclamon survives into the 21st century. The Inquisition, the Holy Roman Church, made certain that every portrait, every statue, every image of this lady was eradicated over the last seven centuries. So we can't know for sure what she actually looked like. I sometimes imagine that she might have looked like Madame Couquet. We know she was at Montsegur and managed to evade the Inquisitors, and then she passes out of recorded history. In the myth, the story is that she never died, but passed alive into the kingdom of heaven, like Christ or the prophet Elijah. And in the myth, in fact, the story is that she climbed the Tabor, the huge mountain overlooking Montsegur, and was allegedly transfigured into a dove. And according to the myth, the dove splits the Tabor with its beak, and the Holy Grail is thrown into the mountain, and which closes around it so that the Grail is hidden within the rock and preserved from the forces of darkness, the forces of Rex Mundi that lay siege to the castle. But the fate of the real Esclamonde remains unknown to us. Several years ago, a skeleton was found very deep beneath the castle, which is on display in the museum in Montsegur, which is the skeleton of a woman in her 70s or 80s, an octogenarian, that was hidden beneath the castle during the siege. We'll never be able to identify who this lady was or why the people who besieged in the castle went to such lengths to hide the body. If that's the case, the lady in the museum died violently, and there we can see from the tip of the spear still embedded in her pelvis that something bad happened to whoever's buried there. Mm. We can also see from the arthritis in her joints and the way that the sutures have knitted together in her skull that she was of a great age. One of the ways that... regardless of whether Esclamonde, the great Esclamonde, died before the final conflict, before the siege or not, one of the ways that she was almost certainly there is that by zooming into the close detail of the history books, we realize that there was more than one of them, that there are at least three different historical personages connected to the siege of Montsegur, all with the same name, all named Esclamonde, the light of the world. This first saintly figure, the Esclamonde the pure, Esclamonde the chaste, the maternal Esclamonde de Foix, who is a pacifist to the quick. But then there is a second Esclamonde, who is in fact the bastard niece of Esclamonde de Foix, sometimes referred to as Esclamonde the bastard, sometimes referred to as Esclamonde l'amoureuse. Her real name was Esclamonde d'Allion. And she was the daughter of the great Esclamonde's brother, Roger Ramon. Now there's a myth concerning her conception. The myth tells us that Roger Ramon, the red-headed Count of Foix, was out hunting a wolf in the high pastures of the Ariège and became lost. After slaying the wolf and coming back through the night, being the lord of the valley, demanded admittance at the first castle he came to, at the first gate, and knocked on the door of a convent, which is a real place. It's the convent of Selenque in the valley of the Ariège. The story is that during the night, Raja Raman deflowers the abbess of the convent. And in some versions, he rapes the abbess of the convent. And then she falls pregnant and gives birth to twins. The boy twin, Ludefois, Wolf von Foix, is named after the father's exploit on the night of his conception, the wolf hunt. So this is, yeah, Wolf von Foix. And his sister, the illegitimate daughter of the Count of Foix, is named after her saintly aunt Esclamonde and becomes the second Esclamonde, Esclamonde d'Allion. But the second Esclamonde is no Cathar saint. She's not raised in the same way, and she is said to have had taken many lovers and to have been extremely fierce indeed. And the second Esclamonde, Esclamonde d'Allion, Esclamonde the Bastard. And I should say as well that one of the real problems of this whole story is that most of the history that's been handed down to us was written by the victors. We're mostly running on accounts left by the Inquisition and by the Crusaders and by the Holy Roman Church. There's really nothing partisan or written from the point of view of the Cathars. So we have to question some points in the story, such as, did Roger Ramon really rape Esclamonde's mother? There's documents that suggest that alternatively he may have actually married her. But in Roman Catholic terms, they didn't believe at that time in the whole concept of divorce. And Roger Ramon's first wife, Philippa, had taken the cloth as a Cathar perfecti. And under Cathar terms, when you take the cloth, that could annul the marriage. And it's possible that his first marriage was legally annulled under Cathar law, but was not recognized by the Holy Roman Church, who thus insists that the second Esclamonde is a bastard or is illegitimate, because they won't recognize the legitimacy of Roger Ramon's divorce. So it's a tricky matter whether to call her a bastard or not. She may have been the legitimate heir. Raised in Pamir. She shortly after her dad's death, she married Bernard d'Allion, who was the Lord of Usson. Bernard was much older than her, but genuinely loved her, and built her own castle in Montaillou. And they lived in separate castles, and I'm not sure that she returned Bernard's affection. She was allegedly a very fierce lady. I think she bore him at least one heir. And then the story is that when the Crusades begin, Esclamonde d'Allion is supposed to have donned man's armor and taken up a sword to go and fight the Crusaders. So unlike the first Esclamonde, who is a pacifist, the second Esclamonde was super fierce and is kind of the warrior woman, the Red Sonja of her day, who literally gets on her horse and takes her sword and allegedly urges the shepherds, organizes them to roll down rocks to ambush the Crusaders and resupplies Montsegur. And is also allegedly connected to the lighting of the night beacons, the fires on the mountaintops that act as a signal amongst the Cathars. And this also harkens back to the pagan notion of the bell fires, lighting the fires on tops of the high mountains. It's worth noting that the Occitan nobility, the local aristocracy, the Defoirs, and the bloodlines that this comes from, believed at the time that they were in part descended from Belisama, the moon goddess, that they were literally divine monarchy who owed their blood directly to the goddess, were descended way back from literally from the white lady, from the moon goddess, and that they received their right to rule from the true sovereignty of the land, the thing that begats kingship. So to some extent, Esclamonde d'Allion's kind of almost an avatar of this extremely fierce Ibero-Celtic warrior goddess, Belisama. And we know that she fiercely protects the castle. The story is also that she took many lovers, and that the story is that she was in love with one of the defenders of the castle. And it's very hard to pinpoint 7 centuries later who someone was sleeping with at the time of the siege. And once you go outside of marriage and the official documents, But there's certainly a running story that Esclamonde Dalion was in love with one of the knights at Montsegur, which is the reason why she keeps returning to the castle. But there's some two other issues too. It's quite possible that the aging Esclamonde de Foix was there at the castle too. And also, if Roger Ramon, the Count of Foix, legitimately married her mother, then it's possible her mother was there as well. Because this issue of Rixender, the abbess who gave birth to Esclamonde Dalion, there is a Rixender in the castle. And quite what happened to Rixender, the mother superior, is unclear in the records as well. So it's quite possible that her mother, her family, and her immediate loved ones were there in the castle and caught up in the siege. Mm-hmm. It's equally unclear what became of her. In the myth, Esclamonde Dalion escapes from the siege along with the survivors of Montsegur and flees over the mountain into the Valley of Usat. And in the myth that's handed down to us, we understand that they retreated into a cave in the Valley of the Ariège, pursued by the Crusaders, and that rather than chasing them into the cave, the Crusaders found it more expedient to bring down the mountain on top of them and to bury them alive in the cave. And in some versions of the story, Esclamonde Dalion, along with the treasure of Montsegur and the last of the Cathars, is meant to perish in the cave of Usat. But the story of the Cathars and the Chatelaine, the guardian of Montsegur, being imprisoned beneath the mountain is also a myth. It's very similar to King Arthur waiting and his knights sleeping beneath the hill, waiting for Avalon to arise again, and links her very clearly to the irrepressible forces of the land and to the real essence of these mountains. Mm-hmm. Now, some researchers have pointed out that there are records that suggest that Esclamonde Dalion did not die in the cave and survived the siege and lived for decades longer. And there's one record that suggests that an Esclamonde Dalion may have been initiated into the Cathar faith something like 15 or 20 years later. And in fact survived the cave, or for all we know, maybe the cave had a second entrance. Sadly, we know that the Inquisition got her husband. They caught up with Bernard Dalion, and he was publicly burned at the stake in Perpignan. So yeah, they killed him for sure. Mm-hmm. Dalion died in the cave or got away, we'll never know. Mm-hmm. And then of course there's a third Esclamonde. Esclamonde de Paray, the third of our trinity. This third Esclamonde was only a child or a young woman, a young girl at the time of the siege. We don't know for sure when she was born. She could have been anything between, 9 years old and 17. So we don't really know how old she was. She was the daughter of the lord of the castle. And essentially a child during the battle, and completely innocent of pretty much anything. It certainly wasn't her fault what happened. The third Esclamonde, Esclamonde de Paray, again named after the great high priestess, the patron of the castle in which she was born. This third Esclamonde dies on the bonfire on the at the stake on March 16th in 1244 at the end of the siege. She is among the Cathars who refused to recant after the fall of the castle. We have a partial list of some of the names of the close to 300 martyrs who perished at the end of the siege, and this third Esclamonde appears on the list. It's super problematic because many people question how a child could possibly die for a faith and how that could ever be justifiable. And I personally imagine that possibly she was already dying, possibly after the the 10 months of starvation and the months of extreme cold on top of the mountain when firewood must have been at a premium, that maybe she was in a very weakened state. Generally, the Cathars didn't hand out their extreme unction, their final initiation, the consolamentum, until people were on their deathbed. It was something that was usually given out as a last rite. And the fact that this possibly 9-year-old child had already received the consolamentum makes me wonder if she wasn't already in a coma or already to, in a state so sick that they didn't think she was going to survive. Certainly, if she had any chance of surviving, it seems unbearably cruel that she would not be allowed to recant, or that she would die a martyr's death the way that happened. But there's no doubt that, yeah, this child of the castle, Sclamond de Perret, perished in the mass burning. And between the three of them, the three faces of them, Esclamond de Foix, Esclamond d'Allion, and Esclamond de Perret, we have three real-life historic personages who actually lived and breathed, who somehow incarnate or the archetypes of the threefold goddess, the schema, I think, first codified by Robert Graves in the White Goddess. All three are conflated by myth and by history into the figure of the guardian of the Grail, this mythic figure, Esclamond de Montsegur, the guardian of the mountain.
Wow, Richard. Absolutely captivating. Absolutely beautiful. I was wondering, with the last little bit of our time together, whether you could share something that's troubling all of us down here in regards to Montsegur, something that's on our radar, and also, of course, coming into view, you know, with the 700-year prophecy that comes to pass next year, 2021, along with the 777th anniversary of the fall of Montsegur. So whilst this beautiful, like, golden age is appearing, there is definitely a shadow that we're aware of as well that is also running parallel to this golden era that we could all taste once again. So could you just let us know a little bit about what's going on with the Emiris group?
Yeah, well, sadly, Catharism is a dualist faith. That it means there's two principles. There's an opposing force. To any extreme of heightened spirit, there's an opposing force of heightened matter. And one of the things which I find most extraordinary and most convincing about the whole story of Montsegur, Esclamond, and the rise, fall, and rise again of the Cathar faith is the number of coincidences. Like the Crusaders show up and burn the faithful and burn Esclamond on March 16th, 1244. Then 7 centuries later, on March 16th, 1944, Nazi panzer tanks roll into Montsegur. And now again in 2021, 777 years after Esclamond dies on the fire, 7 centuries after the death of the last Perfecti, the Valley of Montsegur is ground zero for a international mining consortium known as the Imerys Group, who basically have found a vast deposit of a form of talcum powder, a form of talc called Imerys HARG talc, which is a white soft stone like steatite, which is found in a huge amount underneath the Tabor, the Mountain of Transfiguration, which is the mountain that Esclamond de Foix allegedly climbed when she was transfigured and turned into a dove. This mountain is made of a soft white stone, which is hugely prized by this international mining consortium, who have already been forced into bankruptcy in the United States, thanks to the Johnson & Johnson class actions when people found out that talcum powder causes cancer. So because their product is cancerous, they've been pushed out of the United States. But sadly, the Mountain of the Transfiguration, the Tabor, has become the largest open cast talc mining site in the world, and the survival of the Imrys group depends on it. If they fail in France, the entire mining consortium goes down. Mm-hmm. So it's an existential battle for them too. The talc is an essential ingredient in beauty products as well as paint. So to an extent, it's a force which is a combination of greed and vanity, harnessed together into a force of such awesome destructive potential that it's quite capable of vaporizing the mountain of the Tabor. Which, so again, we see an archetypal confrontation between the forces of spirit and matter happening exactly in time for the Cathar prophecy. Mm-hmm. I should mention as well that this issue of the steatite, the white stone, the stone has been sacred since forever. And the myth of the dove of Montsegur, the dove that splits the mountain of its beak, is closely linked to these Cathar doves, these doves carved out of steatite, out of the Imrys HARG substance, which allegedly were found at the archaeological site. So we can see again that the white dove that splits the mountain clearly like echoes the struggle that's going on, which is so archetypal it might have come straight from the pages of Frank Herbert's Dune or James Cameron's Avatar, but it's playing out right here in 21st century France.
Yeah, wow, Richard, incredible. You've given us so much.
Well, the main thing is to try to figure out what we can do to preserve the POG and to try to hold back the Imrys group, because unfortunately the French government aren't going to help, and Greenpeace France aren't paying any attention. And by the time anyone does anything, the Tabor will probably have been vaporized. The castle will continue to stand, but this is affecting the huge massif that overlooks the castle and the headwaters of the valley, but it also is going to directly affect the lives of the people themselves in Montsegur, who the villagers have all been given the option of lifetime employment in the talc mines. And one of the worst things that is going to come out of this is cutting a road from the village of Montsegur up to the extraction site, because for the first time a road will exist all the way up the valley from the village across into the valley of the Ariège, which will almost certainly open up the valley for commercial exploitation. And
I think what troubles me the most is I've been walking those old Cathar paths up to the Tabor. Haven't quite got to the top yet, but at least two-thirds. And it absolutely breaks my heart to imagine that those authentic old, you know, walked tracks are going to be lost. And all the, you know, the fairy folk, the goblins, the elves, I've seen them. I've seen them with my own eyes. This is a, as you were saying, 150-kilometre wilderness of Western Europe that's still very much intact. So, dearest friends, people listening in and watching this, put your comments in the boxes down below, you know, mentioning things that perhaps we haven't thought of already, but we are being progressive. We are, thanks to Richard and his partner, very much active in figuring out what move to make next. So there is a little rebellion going on down here, but by golly, if you have new ideas for us, please let us know.
I mean, I don't want to be an alarmist, but it does feel like some kind of final conflict between the forces of spirit and matter. But I do feel that if the the white lady or the sovereignty of this land is slain or falls, that the whole of Europe may fall, and or even the world. It feels like we're living in through an apocalyptic period where some kind of final onslaught on Mother Nature is going on all fronts, with deep sea mining, with the assaults on national parks in the US and on UNESCO World Heritage sites all over the world, and people already scrambling to try to mine the moon or Mars. I think some kind of line clearly needs to be drawn, and if that means reawakening the sleeping giants beneath the mountains, and so be it.
Yeah, and dragons. Thank you, Richard. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Let's keep this conversation alive, and no doubt you will hear and see from us real soon, perhaps with a part three. I hope so.
Thanks for having us.
Yes.